Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will it take to get victims of the global sex trade out of the control of their oppressors? While commercial sex is a massive international business, salvation for those caught up in it comes one victim at a time. And rescue efforts are often complicated. Some trafficked persons have no papers to prove where they really belong, or they face ongoing danger of abuse back home, not to mention social stigma. Tough as the fight is, though, there are passionate people working to win it, and New Yorker staff writer William Finnegan explores their efforts in the May 5th issue of the magazine. His article is called The Counter Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Your piece centers on Moldova, which is this tiny former Soviet bloc country between Romania and Ukraine. 1 to 2% of the Moldovans who migrate for work have been trafficked at some point?
Yes, that's the best estimate people can come up with. I mean, most trafficking victims are never identified. They escape. They make their way back to their home countries or whatever becomes of them. They never are in touch with the police or the authorities.
This is a country, though, where the problem is at least acknowledged, and there are public service campaigns trying to inform people about how dangerous it is.
Yes, it's been quite an energetic campaign to warn people about the dangers of immigration, and to the point that you can pretty well say that nobody in Moldova hasn't been warned. But that figure you mentioned, you know, 1 to 2% of migrants are believed to have been trafficked, that's not... You know, to people, Moldova is very poor, in a fairly desperate state, and young people in particular emigrate for greater economic opportunity. And that kind of number is, I don't think, that intimidating to restless, not very worldly young people.
Well, it made me think for a moment of Mexico, which, of course, we're familiar with here in Texas. You know, such a large proportion of their annual income comes from remittances in the country.
Yeah, the percentage in Moldova is actually extremely high. A third of gross national product now comes from remittances. They reckon that, and this is a solid figure, that more than a quarter of the economically active workforce is actually working abroad now.
So how is it that Moldova, though, is such a particular breeding ground for the sex trade?
Well, that situation of mass immigration and sort of economic implosion, Moldova is now, excuse me, the... poorest country in Europe, and very weak law enforcement, very weak government generally, and quite corrupt government and law enforcement is sort of made to order for human trafficking. I mean, trafficking kind of attaches itself to you know, migratory movement, and it's distinguished, I should say, from you know, illegal migration by it can be an unclear line, but basically smuggling of legal migrants is when, you know, you pay to get somewhere and you get there. And the line into trafficking is crossed when coercion or fraud are used. And it's, as I say, being right next to Europe, huge market, and next to the Middle East, also a huge commercial sex market. The Moldovans are just in a very weak position and are preyed upon.
And to describe this in economic terms, which it sounds very harsh, but Moldova is a place where the model is all about natural resources. The people who are trafficked there are quickly sort of bought and then sold at a profit, and whoever has done this in the first place forgets all about them.
That's true. That's true really for the whole former Soviet space, as it's sometimes called, Ukraine, Belarus, Russia itself suffers a lot of the same model of trafficking. There are other models in other parts of the world. One sociologist who's sort of broken this down, done an analysis of the different trafficking models, describes the Southeast Asian trafficking scene, for instance, as more of a trade and development model, where you get big, often Chinese organized crime groups working with villages and families and a certain profit-sharing arrangement. So the girls are taken off to Thailand, say, but a certain amount of the money made goes back into the village and the development of the village, and there's a sort of ongoing relationship. That's not true, as you say, in Eastern Europe.
So what circumstances, Bill, put people particularly at risk for being trafficked?
Generally, I guess the ones you'd expect, poverty, domestic violence, low level of education, people with not so much to lose, especially young women.
I was amazed. It's incredibly sad that there are times when women accept job offers, assuming that they're getting into something that is at least under their own control. Then they arrive in this foreign country and realize they're not in that situation. And there are times when they don't even know where they are.
Yes, that's very much the typical scenario. I mean, the kind of hyper dramatic scenario in which someone is, just kidnapped and drugged into submission and carried off to some foreign country happens, but is quite rare. Much more often, people respond to job ads promising them, positions as waitresses or secretaries or something that will make them a much better salary than what they can get in Moldova. And at some point in the answering of those advertisements, they find themselves and their passport taken away, and suddenly they're going somewhere else, and they lose control of their situation.
And it sounds like the traffickers are very clever, because you actually had someone make a call into one of these, to respond to one of these ads, just to see what it would sound like. Is that right?
Yes, that was a strange one. The trafficking methods, change with the times and with law enforcement catching on to what's going on. I mean, a few years ago, it was primarily newspaper ads offering bogus jobs, and then it shifted more to the internet, and there's a great deal of trafficking now done through ex-victims. But I ran across a newspaper ad in a little section of Moldova, a breakaway section called Transnistria. It's a few years behind, you might say, in this kind of cat and mouse game. And I'd seen an ad for it. It's called Work Travel Dubai, looking for good-looking young women, and that's. There's a Work Travel USA program, all very legitimate, sponsored by the State Department. And so the sort of co-optation of that brand for what sounded like a very dubious program in Dubai, which is a main trafficking destination, I wanted to check out. And so I asked, I couldn't very well go in myself and pretend to be an applicant. I'm not a good-looking young woman. but I send in a local woman who is, and she... they actually brought up the question of trafficking and prostitution and assured her that it was just that they had VIP clientele. These were sales jobs and that they hadn't had any trafficking problems. And it came to sort of no conclusion. It was part of what made me want to go to Dubai, which I ultimately did, being unable to decide about the legitimacy of these kind of job offers.
William Finnegan is my guest. His piece in the May 5th issue of The New Yorker is called The Counter Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. You mentioned a moment ago, and I want to come back to this, that sometimes former victims are the ones who sort of ensnare people. Occasionally they're let go and required to sort of replace themselves.
Yeah, that's become a very common technique that someone who's been trafficked and wants to go home is told you can go if you send, one or two or three other women back in your place. And then you have the situation of somebody going very often to the people who trust her. Most recruiters now in Moldova certainly are women. And, friend, even relative, even daughter, cases in court in Moldova of all of these things, is convinced that there's this wonderful job waiting for them in Italy or Turkey or Cyprus. And some cases, I think, it's even understood that there may be some prostitution involved, but no suggestion of just how little choice in the matter and in the work conditions someone's going to have.
So you profile this extraordinary young woman in the piece who is 26 years old and has basically dedicated her life. She's got some education, some work skills. She wants to stay in Moldova and help people get back home.
Yeah, it's a little bit unusual. Her name's Stella Rotaru, and her just in her dedication to stay in Moldova, though she has other options, members of her family who were overseas and so on, is unusual. She works as a repatriation specialist for an intergovernmental group called the International Organization for Migration, which is a very large group. It's in 120 countries and works closely with the UN. And basically what Stella does is try to help stranded Moldovans get back home. And she would extend that help to people who are not victims of trafficking classically, you know, who are just rotting in jail somewhere or otherwise stranded. But primarily it's victims of trafficking, often not in jail, by the way, but just sort of calling from captivity, you know, desperate and needing help. It can get kind of dramatic.
Yeah, she carries multiple cell phones and she's texting all the time. What is her life like as she's sort of on call to try and help these people?
Well, as you say, she's on call 24/7 and regards her, you know, cell phones kind of ruefully. They never leave her alone. She's often improvising because she'll get calls from far-off places. I think that Moldova's had people trafficked to something like 32 countries now. And sometimes people don't even know where they are, even what country they are in some extreme cases. And so she'll be trying to get clues from them. Often these are very rushed conversations, and often she can't call back. So she's trying to sort of put together all the information she can and then find allies. I mean, often it'll be the police in the country in question, but very often the police are in cahoots with traffickers or local pimps running protection rackets and so on. And so she has to find somebody else. And she's got a long, long list of odd allies, including, you know, prison guards in Dubai and priests and consulates all over the place.
Yeah, how does she sort of work people into her fold to get them on the right side of things?
Well, she can be quite charming. She speaks a number of languages. That helps, including very good English. And she hasn't met most of the people she works closely with. In fact, when I went to Dubai, she gave me a list of, you know, police and other people she works with there, and none of whom have ever met her. They've only spoken on the phone and emailed and texted and worked together. And she just slowly, I mean, it's a network, you know. It's a good title, I suppose, for the piece. I didn't come up with it. The Counter Traffickers, because it's a whole network of people that I hadn't been aware of until I started working on this.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about people that are sort of doing this, even helping these people who are victims. It has to be done under cover of darkness.
Often, yes. I mean, it's quite cloak and dagger. As I say, the police are often no help. I mean, I watched, not in quite in real time, but a drama was going down, and it just kind of wrapped up when I was reporting this earlier this year. A 19-year-old girl from Moldova in Cyprus. Trafficked into a casino brothel and sort of desperate to get out of there, had got a hold of Stella on a you know, sort of clandestine cell phone, and they hatched a plan that, I mean, this all the women working at this brothel were taken once a week to a hospital for a medical checkup, and so the plan was to somehow escape while at the hospital, and one of the struggles was to find a policeman who would help that wasn't already, you know, in cahoots with the brothel owner.
William Finnegan is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He has a piece in the May 5th issue called The Counter Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer William Finnegan. His new piece is called The Counter Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. That's in the May 5th issue of the magazine. You can join us this afternoon by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bill, do people ever have to be smuggled back into the country where they belong?
No, at least not by Stella. I mean, it may be that people who've lost their papers do have to hike in somehow. But this woman, Stella Rotaro, that I was following around and writing about, very much, does her repatriations in collaboration with customs authorities, which doesn't mean that they're always straightforward. I mean, some people actually arrive as stateless persons, and she has to do a lot of talking, but she gets them in legally.
But once she gets them here, that's certainly not the end of repatriation. They have a lot of problems when they arrive back.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say here, I should say back to Moldova.
Yes, back to Moldova. It's true. I mean, they're very often right back in the situation from which they originally fled, you know, poverty and domestic violence and whatever the push factors, as they are called, were that caused them to migrate in the first place. The International Organization for Migration that Stella works for runs a residential treatment center in the capital of Moldova, where people often go first, for counseling and medical treatment. And some family reunification goes on there. You know, families move in and sort of get to know each other again. Often the women have been gone for years, and it's a very, very tough process. And then, of course, to find legitimate employment for people and skills training so that they don't find themselves re-trafficked.
Yeah, they're at greater risk, having been trafficked once, for being trafficked again.
It's true. I mean, a surprising number of people are willing to try their luck again overseas. You know, they come back to Moldova and remember how unhappy they were and don't see very much changed. And I think they now know the ropes and can avoid being, exploited and head overseas again, and very often fall into the same networks that they've really never left.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Nicole in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. I happened to read that article over the weekend and was just sort of dumbfounded. I'm so happy that you have this guest on. And we also just returned from Istanbul. I noticed several places in the article you mentioned Turks and Turkey, and Istanbul is the sort of way stations or in places where people were involved in human trafficking. I was just wondering how prominent Istanbul and Turkey are in that world, because the density of the population in Istanbul, I think, would make it very easy for a person to just get whatever they wanted and nobody would ever notice.
Well, it's for Eastern Europe, Moldova, Russia, Ukraine, and so on. Turkey and in particular Istanbul are, to use the right word, a way station for a lot of human trafficking. Also a destination, but it's a place that you can fly to from many, many places in Eastern Europe. And there's actually a very old slave trade running from Eastern Europe down through Turkey, interrupted in much of the 20th century, and now quite resumed. What used to be called the white slave trade, it went into the Ottoman Empire. And people were sometimes in places like Ukraine at pains to tell me, well, they've been, kidnapping young girls and shipping them to Turkey forever. And it is a real hub for human trafficking now.
Are there third-party countries that are willing to take these women in if it's not safe for them to go back to Moldova or wherever they've come from?
Well, as you know, immigration in the wealthier countries of Western Europe and in the U.S. is a pretty hot issue. It can be quite hard to get countries to acknowledge someone as a trafficking victim who's not a national and to take them in. The U.S. has a program of what are called T-1 visas. There are 5,000 made available each year under the big anti-trafficking law passed in 2000. But strangely enough, relatively few people apply for those visas. They were created and set aside on some highly inflated figures about how much human trafficking happens into the U.S. The figure in the used in the legislation was 50,000 people a year, but there were a lot of sort of lurid press reports leading up to that legislation, you know, getting politicians off the dime, and it don't turn out to be that many people apparently being trafficked to the U.S. because nobody's claiming those visas.
Do you think that's a matter of people not claiming the visas because they don't think they'll get them and that they'll actually end up in more trouble? Or do you think it's a factor of a gross overcount of the people in this country who are in this situation?
I think it's probably both. I mean, there was a gross overcount. The State Department has dropped its estimate now to 14,500 to 17,000, somewhere in there. And even those figures are unsubstantiated. But it's also true that, that special visa in the U.S. is requires that an applicant, a victim, cooperate with law enforcement, which a lot of people are unwilling to do. They're afraid of their traffickers for very good reason, and they're generally afraid of people in uniform and afraid of the authorities. So it's sort of both.
Do you think there's been a mistaken emphasis in this country on sex trafficking as opposed to human trafficking for all forms of labor?
Well, I think that sex trafficking always sort of catches the headlines, and any story with sex and violence in it tends to get published ahead of others, somewhat of a generalization, but has certainly been true of the press coverage of human trafficking, and so in that sense, yes, and certainly U.S. policy has, I think, sort of skewed toward trying to stop sex trafficking with somewhat less attention to labor trafficking, which is actually larger globally than trafficking into the commercial sex industry. Even out of Moldova, where I was just looking, there is a tremendous amount of trafficking of men, women, and children into construction and household service and agriculture, all kinds of places that absorb trafficked labor.
And there are apparently frequent instances of people being trafficked by those they would have trusted, friends and relatives.
Yeah, that's, as I mentioned before, ex-victims often make very effective recruiters, and they typically recruit friends and relatives. And yes, there's a commission to be made, and in a very poor place, a fair number of people will grab that commission. I interviewed women who'd been trafficked by their boyfriends and trafficked by their best friends, told there was a job and, here's your air ticket, and they never see them again, and they end up in forced prostitution.
I understand that there's a serious stigma attached to having been victimized in this way. Do the victims themselves feel ashamed of what's happened to them, or do they sort of wish that everyone would get over their prejudice of them?
Well, hard to generalize. I met women who had been trafficked into prostitution and were pretty clear about it, that it wasn't their fault, something had happened to them, and even met and interviewed victims who were pursuing legal cases against their traffickers, which, as I mentioned, can be dangerous and lets people know what happened, and especially in conservative rural communities, which most victims come from in Eastern Europe, it's a big stigma that this young woman was a prostitute in some foreign country. Even just going to the city, young women risk that kind of stigma, and so it really ranges. And then there are so many women who manage to get home, but never identify themselves to aid agencies or the authorities in any way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Speaking with William Finnegan of The New Yorker, who has a piece called The Counter Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade in the May 5th issue of the magazine. So I'm curious as to how these abusers and traffickers, wherever they exist, continue to get away with things and what law enforcement efforts there are, if any, to cope with the problem.
Well, there's quite a lot. It's not an easy thing to stop. But the U.S. has really sort of made itself the world's policeman on this subject. And besides the effort to stop trafficking into this country, where there's been some kind of, false starts, I would say, problem overestimated and so on. The State Department has a dedicated office to combating trafficking worldwide and does an annual report on every country, how well it's doing in its anti-trafficking efforts, and then rates them, tier one for countries that are doing their part, tier two for those who could improve, and tier three for those who are doing nothing and can be economically sanctioned by the U.S. So there's that push from this country, which is felt worldwide. There's quite a lot of activism in Europe. The Interpol can be quite effective. But, you're talking about national police force, a transnational problem. And very, very difficult to combat, and a lot of organized crime involvement. And in some ways that's easier to combat because it has a kind of authority structure than the really freelance kind of amateurish recruiting and trafficking, which is primarily what goes on inside Moldova, for instance.
Well, the U.S. has given, $500 million in aid to Moldova since 2000?
Well, $500 million altogether, not so much to Moldova, just $11 million to Moldova, which in Moldova is actually a lot.
Okay, so this is $500 million in anti-trafficking aid.
Yes.
Is that right? How is that money spent? Is it used to repatriate victims or to prosecute, or is it used to sort of motivate the governments in those countries to do what needs to be done?
Primarily, I would say to motivate governments and to motivate prosecutions. There's a strong emphasis on prosecution in the U.S. aid. It's to police departments primarily. Training, stationing of FBI agents, to try to instruct people in how organized crime networks can be rolled up. There's lots and lots of resistance to that work, though. Some of it just flat-out corruption in the police forces in poor countries and other countries, but tremendous amount of corruption in customs and border guards and embassy personnel all over the place. And that's really quite difficult for any outside power to affect.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak to Ramus in Dallas. Hi, Ramus.
Yes, hi. I would like to say that your guess is absolutely right. I crossed the whole Europe and the Atlantic, stowed away in a container all the way to Canada. So I went through a lot and I met a lot of people. And it was always people from my own country who used me. And never the locals, like American, Canadians, or whatever. For example, in Canada, I was used for $1 an hour working in the middle of the summer close to Lake Ontario, where the humidity was very high, in construction. And it happened to be a person from my own country, not just from my own country, from my own town, which went to kindergarten with my father, which I never told him even to this day, because I was afraid of the consequences. So your guess is absolutely right. It's always, unfortunately, people from immigrants like yourself who have a legal status that are abusing and using other immigrants.
Ramus, can you hang on the line for a second? Can you help us understand how desperate people are that you accept terms that you know may turn out bad? Did you determine to have yourself smuggled into the country and then you were victimized after that?
Right.
Okay.
Well, the key is that, in my case at least, they never tried to victimize me from the beginning because I would have never accepted. They changed the terms in the middle of the game.
Right.
And you see, those people are the ones who know your situation the best, because themselves, at some point, they were in that situation where they were, hopeless and they didn't have a status and they were at the mercy of other people. And you think that they would have more compassion. And, if it happened to you, you think that, I would never try to do it to other people. But, they can blame the countries all they want. It's the people, who are using other fellow immigrants.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
What do you say when you hear that, Bill?
Gosh, is what I say. I mean, the pattern that your caller described of starting often immigration or illegal immigration with one agreement, having the terms change midway and finding himself working for $1 an hour or $1 a day or whatever it is in construction in Canada, that's a sort of a classical trafficking story. But stowing away in a container and traveling across across borders and across the ocean in a container, that's, I know it happens, but it's incredibly dangerous, and it's pretty unusual.
We have an email from Bonnie in Dallas who asks, what, if anything, is being done about the clients of people who are enslaved?
The clients of people who are enslaved, do you mean like...
I suppose like Johns.
Johns in case of prostitution. Not very much in most places. I mean, Sweden in 1999, which had previously decriminalized prostitution entirely, sort of recriminalized the purchase of sexual services. So the customers, the clients, were at risk legally, but the women themselves, typically women selling sexual services, were not, which was a sort of new policy twist that a lot of people find interesting, and the United States has studied it at some length, and even most ironically, Elliot Spitzer was enthusiastic about that model and actually incorporated some of it into New York state law before he got into the trouble he got into. So there is some interest and some effort in curbing demand, coming down on the demand side of the equation, and I think there could be a lot more.
Has that changed the dynamic in Sweden?
Well, the results are quite mixed there. I mean, advocates for sex workers in Sweden have not been happy about it. They say that, I mean, street prostitution is way down. It's riskier to do that. But advocates for sex workers say that it's just driven things underground and made it more dangerous. Whether or not it's broadly popular with the public, so it's not liable to be changed. People are happy to see, less street prostitution around. And whether it's actually affected trafficking, I think it's unclear. Stockholm officials say it has, but it's really very hard to know. I mean, it's by definition, a clandestine business.
William Finnegan is my guest. His piece in The New Yorker's May 5th issue is called The Counter-Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or write email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William Finnegan. His piece in The New Yorker's May 5th issue is called The Counter-Traffickers, Rescuing the Victims of the Global Sex Trade. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Bill, one of the things we really haven't talked about much yet is the effect that this has on children. There are a couple of different ways this happens, but for one thing, many of the women who have children as a result of their trafficking experiences have a really hard time being effective parents. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it, but I did visit this treatment center for victims of trafficking in Moldova, where, among other services they provide are sort of controlled environments for family reunification, which primarily means women with their children. And in some cases, as you say, these children are the result of their trafficking experience, so to speak. I mean, the biological fathers would be pimps or customers. And of course, a lot of the mother's feelings, this is according to the psychologist at this center, terrible feelings about their trafficking experience end up getting transferred to these kids, and it can be a very, very explosive, difficult relationship.
And then there are other children who are just what you call social orphans, who have one or both parents leave the country to try and find work.
Yeah, it's a huge problem in Moldova, that where you have such a very high percentage of the population emigrating overseas, including lots of parents of kids, parents of young kids that have been struggling to feed those kids, leave their children in care situations that fall apart one way or another, and they end up in orphanages. I visited a couple of orphanages in Moldova. There are a lot. And it's not necessarily that the kids in there, that their parents are both dead, that they're classically orphans, but they're, as you say, what are called, they're social orphans. And they're really left behind by immigration. And it's not even that their mothers or their parents have necessarily been trafficked, probably not. But I was struck at one of the orphanages I visited. I asked about, because they are pushed out when they're 16 from these orphanages. They're not really ready to live independently and are considered extremely vulnerable to trafficking. I asked the orphanage director about that. She said, well, she wasn't sure if any of her kids had been trafficked when they left, but she said they got people from international organizations coming in and giving workshops and lectures about trafficking to the kids so that they know the dangers, and that after those lectures, she said, always at least one child comes up and says, that's what happened to my mother. She must have been trafficked. That's why she left me.
Hmm. How is it that Moldova got into such dire economic straits? Because before independence in 91, it had factories, it had farms. What went wrong?
Well, it was actually one of the better off parts of the Soviet Union. It had a niche, in the Soviet economy, a huge internal market. It's known for its wines and its fruit, primarily agricultural, and it had a fair number of factories, a lot of the military sited there by Moscow. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, Moldova lost that internal market. A lot of those factories closed, and part of the country broke away, the more Russian and more industrialized side of the country. And the economy just started sort of cratering in on itself. Without that captive market, it really didn't have anywhere to sell its products. And that's when you start to get the massive immigration.
Well, and it would seem as if the EU doesn't have a vested interest in improving things in Moldova because they're getting Moldovan labor cheap.
Yeah, that would be a sort of hard-headed way to look at it. The EU, has been expanding eastward, though, and it's right up to Moldova's border. Romania has now joined, and Moldova would very much like to join, but doesn't nearly qualify. It's far too poor, too corrupt, too poorly organized, and yet it's right there at the gates. But I think the EU will take some time to digest Romania, Bulgaria, some of the other new members, and Moldova is going to remain on the outside, just supplying, as you say, cheap labor.
I guess the way that the EU is sort of expanding and growing allows for some sort of greater cultural understanding of the situation in Moldova. I know Romania is a different place, but they're in better condition, but perhaps they have a better understanding of the Moldovans and what might need to take place there. Do you think that's a factor in the growth of the EU?
I don't know that. I don't know what EU thinking is. I know in Eastern Europe there's just a tremendous amount to be gained by not only by joining the EU, but even in the case of Moldova, having your near neighbor, Romania, where they basically speak the same language. I mean, they were once part of the same country. In fact, they were carved up after World War II. I mean, they've been carved up any number of times, but the latest carving creating these borders was after World War II. And tremendous advantage in having, yes, a near neighbor like Romania sort of on the golden ladder and able to open its border to a certain extent, I mean, within EU constraints to its neighbors in Moldova.
Do Moldovans who migrate for legitimate jobs, whether permanently or temporarily, do they tend to have to do so illegally, or are they able to move about pretty freely?
And I'm not sure what the numbers are between legal and illegal immigration. It seems that there's a great deal more illegal immigration, but I've never seen hard numbers on that. I mean, there are all kinds of semi-legal things people do. I mean, there are always tour buses heading off to Amsterdam, for a Hans Christian Andersen festival, and nobody's ever heard of Hans Christian Andersen, and they're all drilling themselves on the bus, and I mean, the plan isn't really to go to the festival, but to jump off the bus in Belgium or wherever.
Go find work.
Yeah, and so but it's hard even to get tourist visas. I mean, people pay tremendous amounts of money. It's a kind of horrible irony that the poorest country in Europe ends up being the place where you have to pay the most to, and it's the poorest people who have to pay the most to get visas. I mean, these are illegal fees. charged by embassy personnel and travel agencies, you know, all kind of dubious intermediaries, that charge thousands of euros for, and that's to a poor person because that poor person can't qualify for, you know, a tourist visa to Western Europe, whereas a rich Moldovan has no trouble coming and going, let alone someone who's in an EU country.
So what sort of international pressure is effective to help people who are being trafficked? Is there anything that can be done that's not being done right now by countries in a position to help?
Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy in this area, lots of kind of shows of seriousness that are just that. They're just displays. And I think that in destination countries, probably more than source countries, there could be a greater seriousness about helping victims, not punishing victims. I mentioned, I think I went to Dubai, a sort of prime destination country for human trafficking in Eastern Europe, certainly, and in much of Asia as well, and in Africa too. I mean, there are just people from all over the world there working as prostitutes and under all kinds of terrible conditions in construction. And while Dubai recognizes that it has a major problem and especially a major sort of image problem, a place that's trying to become a mass tourist destination and world business center, whether they're actually getting serious about helping trafficking victims and breaking up, especially the protection rackets with the police and the border police there, is another matter. And I do think some of the American pressure being applied with these annual State Department reports is effective. But you have to really get down in amongst the infrastructure and the enforcement in a country, not just talk to the leadership.
Yeah, tier one is countries that are doing what they ought to be doing. Tier yes. two are the countries that need some work but are making an effort. Where does Moldova lie right now?
They've fallen into an in-between. Tier three is sort of bottom. That's where you find, you know, Burma and North Korea and for that matter, some of our allies like Saudi Arabia that can't very well be economically sanctioned and have long, long traditions of slavery, household and otherwise. But they created, the State Department created something in between Tier 2 and Tier 3 called the Tier 2 Watch List.
Which is like purgatory.
Yeah, it's a sort of red flagged area where you're about to be dropped into Tier 3 and could suffer economic sanctions. And for a country like Moldova and some of the other countries in that situation, very dependent on aid, including U.S. aid, it's a serious matter. And they're dropped there when you know, it's reckoned that they're really not trying very hard. And in the case of Moldova, there was a big scandal a couple of years ago. The head of a U.S.-funded police center to combat trafficking in persons, I mean, a big thing for Moldova, this big modern policing center with all its resources, he was named by a leading trafficker as one of his leading partners. Bit of an embarrassment. And the Moldovans have not pursued it judicially at all. I mean, they have not brought charges against the guy, and the U.S. response has been to drop them onto the watch list, and the U.S. continues to pressure Moldova to take action against this fellow. I write a bit about this, but so far nothing's happened, and I kind of doubt anything will.
And it seems to be very often, if anybody ends up being prosecuted, it's people at the very lowest rungs.
Yeah, they're the easiest to catch. Yeah. They can't buy any protection, just the recruiters, the smallest fish, as you say.
Mm-hmm. You include in the piece an adage that you've heard more than once while traveling in Moldova, which is that the woman who is not beaten is like a house that is not cleaned. That speaks of a very misogynist culture.
Yeah.
Is that part of the problem?
It is, I would say, yeah. I mean, it's a sort of terrible saying about wife beating, basically, and how it's okay. And people will sort of repeat it as a grim example of some of the kind of village backwardness you'll find in Moldova, and I would say in plenty of other countries too. And its connection to trafficking is that there seems to be a tremendous correlation between who gets trafficked and whether they come from a household afflicted by domestic violence. I mean, an anti-trafficking group in Moldova did a study where they came up with a correlation of something over 90%. So it's, I mean, one has to work out what it all means. And it, first of all, tells you there's a lot of household violence there, but you know, which often goes in connection with alcoholism and unemployment, of course. And it has, though, this kind of almost demonic connection to trafficking. I mean, the young women who become vulnerable to trafficking have already been victimized at home to a very large extent.
1-800-933-5372 is the phone number for the show. Let's speak to Ken in Granbury. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I've read that there's quite a lot of pornography coming out of Eastern Europe, and I suspect there's a lot of overlap between the kinds of people who are trafficked and otherwise exploited. And even though these people aren't taken out of the country, they're certainly the results of their labors are certainly marketed over here. And so my question simply is that being dealt with in through the anti-trafficking people and governmental efforts?
Thanks for your call.
That's an interesting question, and the answer is not that I know of. There's not a lot of sort of anti-pornography law enforcement going on in much of the world. I mean, there are places, of course, where pornography is completely illegal, much of the Middle East and so on. But there is an overlap, and plenty of women who are trafficked into forced prostitution are also compelled to perform in pornography. They work as strippers, dancers. I mean, all these industries, the commercial sex markets, overlap. But I doubt that. I mean, Moldova, for instance. I don't know that a lot of pornography is actually produced there. It's a very poor place, and not that it takes so much to produce pornography, I suppose. But it's more like that people are trafficked into prostitution, and that would include some pornography.
So you end your piece, Bill, with a sort of depressing story of a woman who does come home and is reunited with her daughter and her husband, but things don't look good in terms of her sort of getting back into normal life. Is that a reflection of your pessimism about the nature of the problem and whether or not it's going to be solved anytime soon?
I guess it is. I mean, I went along to the airport for this repatriation with Stella, the repatriation specialist I write about, and it was very bleak. I mean, it was really quite awful. The woman came, and her husband was just interested in how much money she brought with her. But then I didn't really understand what I was looking at either. I mean, Stella said, you know, he may not even understand that she's a victim of trafficking, which seems sort of amazing from the outside. But when you look closely at it, I mean, here's what he knows, and here's what we're allowed to tell him, and here's what she may or may not have told him. And basically she was saying, look, as far as he's concerned, she's been gone a long time. They weren't getting along before she left, and she ought to be bringing a lot of money back. So it was very bleak and in some way representative, but there are also some happy reunions, I think. It's just not the one I chose to end with.
William Finnegan is a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can read The Counter Traffickers in the May 5th issue. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.